Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How should America plan for its future energy needs? Should we keep extracting and burning fossil fuels, expand our use of green options like wind and solar, or should we place an emphasis on inventing new vehicles and devices that require less energy than the ones they replace? A lot has changed on the U.S. energy front over the past several years. Oil imports are down, renewable energy production is up, and brand new fights have broken out over whether hydraulic fracturing to capture shale gas is a blessing or a curse. So how can we fold these new developments into our desires for clean, affordable, and secure sources of power? Michael Levy is Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called The Power Surge: Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
So one major takeaway from this book for me is that we need to stop wasting our time looking for this unilateral magic bullet solution to our need for energy.
I mean, that's absolutely right. We have a lot of things that we want energy to do. We want to have affordable energy to power our economy. We want to produce energy to create jobs and economic growth. We want to be secure in the world. We want a clean environment and to mitigate climate change. It shouldn't be a shock that there isn't one energy source that does all of that for us.
So how is it that only one in 20 Americans surveyed feature increasing fossil fuel production and also expanding development of alternative energy?
Well, that survey, to be fair, gave the options of supporting fossil fuel development or supporting alternative energy. So first, that reflects people's mentality when they don't even think to offer the third option of wanting to see gains in both. But the fact that only 5% of people step up and say, wait a minute, I don't want to make a fundamental choice right now between these pieces, I think says something about the broader currents in American energy. Part of what explains it to me is that we've had a long time to get stuck in our ways. This isn't just a split that exists today. It's a split that goes back a very long time. In the aftermath of the first energy crisis in 1973, we started with responses on multiple fronts. We approved a big pipeline across Alaska to boost oil production. We had the first ever rules for fuel economy on cars and trucks. But within a few years, by the end of the 1970s, the country was gripped by these paralyzing battles where the only thing everyone could agree on was that you either had to pick a hard path of fossil fuels or a soft path of efficiency and alternatives. And we've got stuck pretty intensely in that ever since.
So this fall marks 40 years since the oil crisis drove U.S. leaders and average citizens alike to call for energy independence. Has that ever been a realistic option for us? Was there a point even before then in our history when that might have been a possible scenario for the future?
We were essentially energy independent for a long time. World markets were balkanized, and the United States produced as much oil as it consumed, or at least could produce as much oil as it consumed if it wanted to. But in the late 1960s and early 1970s, Texas's ability to be the swing producer for the United States and the world went away as consumption skyrocketed and our ability to produce declined. And after the 1973 oil crisis, it became very clear that we were going to be importing a lot of oil. Now, in the decades that came after that, in order to make ourselves more secure in this world of imports, we deliberately built global markets. We made it so that you could get oil from anywhere and take it to anywhere, roughly speaking, allowing us to not be cut off by any one country. Now, fast forward to today, we suddenly have this rapidly rising oil production at the same time as we've seen consumption decline, which makes it not crazy to imagine that we, or at least North America, could produce as much oil as we consume. But because we've changed the global market, because we've changed the global energy system, we would remain interconnected. Today, even if we produced all the oil we consume, if something went wrong on the other side of the world, our oil prices would skyrocket, and our economy and our consumers would be harmed. We would get more benefits because we would be producing more profitably, but we would still be pinned in by that fear of skyrocketing prices and of economic damage, and wouldn't be truly independent in the way I think a lot of people have sought for decades.
So there's essentially no way to detach from that global market.
We can decide to detach from the global market, but that would be a radical change in the global economy. I can't imagine it would happen in isolation from a reversal of globalization more broadly. We would be, if we did it in a crisis, cutting off our allies and our friends from sources of oil, we benefit enormously from open global markets. So to take this one step within the energy world and cut ourselves off, I don't think it's something that we're going to broach seriously.
All right, so let's talk about the fact that we are importing less oil today than we were a few years ago. This was something that a decade or two ago, I don't think too many people could have imagined was possible.
And that's right. And I don't think a lot of people did imagine that this would happen. But in 2005, we saw U.S. oil consumption peak. It's fallen by roughly 2 million barrels a day since then. And in 2009, our oil production reversed. It bottomed out, started rising. Last year, we saw the largest one-year increase in oil production in U.S. history. And we've seen an increase in oil production of, again, roughly 2 million barrels a day. This is all set against a backdrop where the United States was consuming about 20 million barrels a day. So this is a big set of changes, and the trends underlying it, high prices, technological developments, better ways to produce oil, more efficient ways to power our cars and trucks, I think make this trend poised to continue. And we're seeing benefits. We're seeing job creation and wealth creation. We're also seeing, particularly from production of additional oil. And at the same time, we're seeing ourselves become more resilient to volatile prices because our cars use less oil in order to get where they need to.
Would those changes in energy efficiency of vehicles have happened due to market demands, or did we really need the CAFE standards and other measures which were put in place to try and move us along to more efficient vehicles?
I think high prices have been the central factor driving us toward more efficient vehicles. You can see that from the data on how efficient our cars are compared to how efficient they're required to be under the CAFE rules. But the CAFE rules are important, and so are efforts to promote technology development. First, they keep people focused on buying efficient cars, looking at a long time horizon, even if oil prices fluctuate. And they give car companies a longer planning horizon so that they get a bigger incentive to put more efficient cars into their fleet, bring down their costs, get people to buy them. And that makes it possible when prices rise for people to buy great cars that get great fuel efficiency instead of just buying a small car that gets better fuel efficiency because it's an inferior vehicle.
So what about the issue of peak oil? Is it still looming somewhere out there in the future, just maybe farther in the future than we might have thought a few years ago?
I don't think peak oil is a particularly useful way to think about scarcity of energy supplies. It's been the way we've talked about it a lot. And we've had somewhere around 5 episodes over the last century where we thought that we were peaking in our oil consumption and about to run out. You can go back more than 100 years and find maps of all the oil remaining in the United States. Those maps don't include most of the oil that we've actually developed in the intervening time. But and we've seen also recently, because of these gains in U.S. oil supplies, people say peak oil is dead. And it's important to not be fixated on this idea that we're about to turn the corner and we're about to have skyrocketing prices. But I don't think we should flip the other way. People talk about how we're awash in oil, about how this is an age of abundance. The reality is that oil prices remain very high. And we still live in a world of oil that is relatively scarce in some important ways. With those high prices, even as we produce more, it's important to be cutting our consumption. It's economically beneficial to us. It helps our national security. So I fear that we will flip from this terror of scarcity to a real laziness that comes from a misplaced sense of abundance.
So let's talk about wind and solar technology. What sort of difference has the adoption of mass production made in the costs of these as sources of energy?
So when we think about alternative energy sources, we have a habit of imagining that some guy in a lab is going to come up with a big breakthrough and radically change the cost structure, make these come into the market. And until that happens, they're not going to be big improvements. I think that's the wrong way to think about alternative energy. Part of what needs to happen is that kind of fundamental science and applied science, but part of what's happening is exactly what you pointed to. As you put the technologies out in the field, people learn how to operate them more efficiently. You know how to turn your wind turbine in order to take advantage of the wind. You learn how to integrate this intermittent electricity that comes and goes with the wind or with the sun into the broader electric grid. On the solar side, you learn how to provide financing for people, right? Solar panels are expensive up front but save you on electricity costs later. So you learn how to build business models that help people get these on their roofs and then save money down the line. You learn all sorts of things that you're not going to figure out in the lab, and you get economies of scale. When you produce more of something, you're able to bring the cost down, particularly if you ramp up in a measured way so you don't get supply chain crunches and labor crunches. So we're seeing a lot of those gains as we ramp up, and in solar in particular, we've seen very big drops in cost. People talked about a dollar for a watt of solar modules, a holy grail for solar. We've met that, but now the big challenges remain. How do you install these things in an efficient way? How do you finance them in an efficient way? And that we only learn as we try.
Of course, when you're looking at industrial production of solar and wind in particular, you also need, there's the expense of getting things from where the energy is captured to where people need to use it. Talk a little bit about the infrastructure development that's needed and whether there is an ideal balance between public and private investment in this kind of infrastructure.
So the sun doesn't necessarily shine where people want electricity. The wind doesn't always blow where people need electricity. And by the way, there's an analog for fossil fuels. You don't always produce oil where you want to refine it, or natural gas where you want to use it in industrial facilities or homes or power plants. And so you need a framework where private developers can invest. But the reality is these are long-lived projects. They are typically regulated so that the developers can get a good return on their investment, a reasonable return on their investment. And so the public sector is going to have an important role. I don't think the public role in these projects is in bringing money to them. I think you can raise capital in the correct regulatory environment. But the public side really does need to get that environment right. And for transmission, for electricity, the key really is making sure you can build these across long distances. For pipelines, we can do siting across multiple states in fairly straightforward ways in the grand scheme of things. For power lines, you need to get approval state by state by state, and that doesn't always line up. But the reality is if we're going to move to some of these other sources, we're going to need to build these power lines across long distances. And I should say that's not only for alternative energy sources. Let's imagine we're talking about nuclear. There are communities that will accept nuclear power. They might not be close to the places that might need the electricity. So again, there's this geographical constraint that being able to build the right power lines helps us escape a little bit.
And, you know, when you talk about infrastructure for fossil fuels, it can be challenging politically to get pipelines in place over long distances because people might be very happy to have the oil, but they don't necessarily want their property torn up.
I think that's absolutely right. Look, if we have the demand that we have for energy and the demand that we have for oil, then if we go blocking individual sources or blocking individual pipelines, we're basically playing whack-a-mole. We'll see other sources pop up elsewhere and other transportation routes. If it's not a pipeline here, it'll be a pipeline there. If it's not a pipeline at all, it'll be a tanker coming into the coast. So in the near and medium term, we just need to make sure we do these things safely as long as we are consuming substantial amounts of oil. And over time, we need to be cutting our consumption. Ultimately, if we're consuming less, we need less of this infrastructure, and we're able to avoid some of those risks. But inevitably, these things involve risks. And rather than pretending that we can get rid of them by blocking one here or there, we need to make sure that we have the rules right so they're done safely.
Michael Levy is my guest. He is Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called The Power Surge: Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. You can join the conversation right now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations, Michael Levy. His new book is called The Power Surge, Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Michael, another energy source we have in abundance in this country is coal, but coal remains and will remain problematic into the future.
Absolutely. Coal comes with local environmental impacts. It also, when you burn it, generates carbon dioxide emissions that intensify climate change. Unless we can develop the technologies at reasonable cost that capture those emissions and bury them underground, we shouldn't be precipitously moving away from coal, but we're already seeing coal's market share cut by abundant natural gas at relatively low prices, and we're seeing operators switch from coal to gas, in part aided by regulatory measures that fully burden coal with the cost of its environmental damage, but in large part because of this extraordinary change we've seen in hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling that has unleashed these large quantities of shale gas. I think we'll see further inroads into coal's market share as low gas prices are sustained and as we see new regulations coming that tilt the balance between coal and gas further. We saw the president announce earlier this week that he's asking the Environmental Protection Agency to write rules that reduce carbon dioxide emissions in the power sector. There's very little chance that those won't further tilt the field from coal and toward gas.
Give us some perspective on extraction of shale gas, which has been heralded by some as sort of the solution to all of our problems and derided by others as a very serious environmental crisis in the making. What did you learn about where the truth lies?
There are ways to do shale gas development well. There are ways to do it poorly. I tend to focus on three major areas of concern. First is how we dispose of the wastewater that comes out of the wells. Mm-hmm. The second is the cumulative impact of a lot of drilling in an area on air quality. And the third is the community impacts, lots of truck traffic in a lot of parts of the country, not so much in Texas, but in the Northeast you have an influx of people from out of state working on development, and that integrating that into communities is difficult. But the choices the community makes and the rules that are put in place make a spectacular difference. People are familiar with that. In Texas, when I was writing the book, I traveled in southern Ohio where people were new to development, mm-hmm. But were seeing the potential for a lot of drilling. And I talked to Bill Dix, a dairy farmer in the area. He told me about two trips he took. He traveled into Wetzel County, West Virginia, and he said that the development was done so horribly that he had nightmares for days. And then he said he traveled into Bradford County, Pennsylvania, also nearby, where they had had a lot of development in the Marcellus. He said, first, the rules weren't perfect, but they were a lot better. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the community had gotten together and made sure they understood how development was going to work, made sure that they had good leases, and made sure they had the right rules, not just coming from the state, but coming from their own contracts for development. He said that was far better, and it helped convince him that he wanted to see development happen in his neck of the woods, but that he also would work with other landowners and would want to see regulators doing the good job.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Mark in Arlington. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Chris. Thanks. Good show today.
Thank you.
I just put an 8-kilowatt system on my roof, an 8-kilowatt solar system, mm-hmm. and it's tied directly into my electrical meter. It's called net metering that we have here in Texas. And so I don't have to worry about the whole how do I get it to my house grid issue. I'm taking more of a personal micro, I guess, way of managing it.
Yeah.
And the guys who did it out of Native Solar in Dallas and Encore, the incentives were there. But there are no state incentives to really make it affordable, so I went with a lease. And what I found is that if I take it a little more personally and I really take responsibility for it, I'm seeing my electrical costs drop. And when the rest of electricity goes up, I think mine are going to be much less than the market.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Michael?
So I think it's great that Mark is taking advantage of the technologies that are out there and the incentives that are out there to get rooftop solar on his home. And as more people do that, we learn how to bring down costs and make that more feasible broadly. We still have some big challenges in integrating that more broadly. First, there are various subsidies that support deployment, and that can work at a limited scale, but once everyone picks up the technology, the subsidies become a big fiscal burden, so we have to figure out how to transition that over time. The other piece is on the net metering side, which is an important tool in helping people take advantage of these technologies. It allows them basically to sell electricity back into the grid when they're producing a surplus. But someone like Mark is still depending on the rest of the electricity system to provide backup when the sun isn't shining or when there's insufficient power from the panels for his home. And he is also relying on the grid that's being built by the transmission distribution companies in order to move that electricity back out and to bring it in when he needs it. And we need to find the right mechanisms for sharing the cost of all these components of the system so that the system remains reliable and so that all the components work together. And it's very much in the weeds, but it's a very important piece as we move forward, integrating these different elements so that we can enjoy their benefits.
Is there, Michael, a social critical mass that needs to happen? So in other words, if Mark and nine of his neighbors decide to make this choice, do the other four families on the block think, well, let's just go for it, as opposed to him seeming like an anomaly? And I don't know that this is the case, but an unusual fact in his neighborhood.
I do think that first movers, early movers make a big difference, right? Until the first person on your block gets something, everyone looks at it as a theoretical possibility. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some guy's trying to sell it to you, but are you really going to get the savings that they're promising? Is it really going to work? Are they going to fix it when you got problems with these panels on your roof? As people adopt these different tools, you learn. Now, sometimes maybe the maintenance isn't good and the installation isn't good, but when they are, people learn and they become more confident in the ability of these sources to deliver. So you do get some of that critical mass. The other critical mass we need, let's be blunt, is on the policy side of things. It's important for individuals to take big steps, but if we want to tackle our big national and global problems, whether that is in consuming more oil than is safe for us in terms of our geopolitical place in the world, or having excessive carbon emissions that put us at risks, at intolerable risks of climate change. We need policy measures that create incentives across the economy for people, even if they don't particularly care, to factor these damages in to their everyday economic decisions and help steer the economy in a more resilient and cleaner direction.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Jonathan in Dallas. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello. I'm curious why we're still talking about the power grid. Shouldn't we be talking and investing more in a distributed power system like the Bloom Box?
Any thoughts, Michael?
So the first thing is that we have an enormous amount invested already in the power grid, and that sunk cost means we're going to take advantage of a lot of that out in the future. So we want the sources that are putting energy into that grid to be as cost-effective and as clean as they reasonably can be. But we do also need to be talking about distributed generation. And as the last caller certainly pointed out, there's a lot of potential there. I wouldn't want to make a decisive bet on distributed generation right now. There are some important economies of scale that you get from centralized generation. And I think we're going to have to see how this plays out. We had a go-around over distributed generation, again, in the late 1970s, where proponents of the soft path on energy said, one of the things we can do is save enormous amounts on transmission distribution by pursuing distributed energy. Now, that failed in part because of technology and cost, but in part because our regulations are not set up to work for distributed generation. So what we need to do is make sure we have a regulatory environment where these various sources, whether centralized or distributed, can thrive, and then let them all go at it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We also have email available at think@kera.org. Next on the line is Anne in Dallas. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Enjoying the show.
Thank you.
Michael, my question is regarding the pipeline. Hopefully we'll get it built, the XL pipeline. In regards to the pipeline versus the hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil that are being transported every day down south to the refineries via rail. I think the rail is dangerous and not necessary. I think the pipeline is the best way to go. What are your thoughts about that pipeline versus these all of this oil being transported via rail?
So you're absolutely right that we're seeing a lot of oil shipped by rail as an alternative to pipeline. And rail transport is dangerous. You have car derailments, and that can lead to big environmental problems. At the same time, you don't have rail regulated in the same way as you do pipelines because it's not a traditional means of transporting oil unless you go back to the Rockefellers 100 years ago. To me, pipelines are a safer way of doing things. I think there's a bigger discussion about the benefits and risks of increased oil production. I come down in arguing that the benefits of letting the pipeline go forward almost certainly exceed the costs. But we do need to get the safety on the pipeline right, too. There was a National Academy of Sciences report out 2 days ago saying that what's moved in the pipeline, diluted bitumen, is no more corrosive to pipelines than traditional oil. And so that's one fear that's been raised before that looks to be overdone. At the same time, it is more difficult to clean this stuff up if it's spilled, particularly if it's spilled into water, because it sinks, and it's very difficult to clean up. And so I do think it would make sense for us to require companies transporting this diluted bitumen, this sort of material that would be in the Keystone Pipeline, make them pay into a spill liability fund. Right now, what they ship isn't actually classified as oil, so they don't have the same requirements to pay in and be liable for the risk they create. I think everyone who is transporting oil should be liable for the risks associated with it.
Given the technologies that exist right now and that we know are effective, is it possible to keep increasing our oil and gas production and cut CO2 emissions at the same time?
I think it certainly is today. You need to look at oil and at gas separately. For oil, there's no question that additional oil production increases global carbon dioxide emissions. I think if we look at the way global markets work, our increased production over the long run should be mostly offset by others cutting their production in order to keep prices stable. The key question is, will we continue to reduce our consumption? If high prices remain, we will reduce our consumption. The thing that worries me is that we'll get lulled into a false sense of security by high supplies and not pursue the policy measures, the regulation, the support for innovation that we need to bring down our consumption over time. But if we're able to combine increased production with this sustained effort to reduce consumption, I don't see why the two can't coexist for quite a while. Natural gas is more complicated. Right now, abundant gas is mostly displacing coal. It's displacing renewables a bit, but mostly displacing coal. And in doing that, it is bringing down our emissions. The big question for the long haul is, can we get to a point where we have moved from coal to gas, and then we move from gas to technologies that produce no emissions, whether that is renewable energy, nuclear power, or natural gas or coal with technologies that capture the carbon dioxide emissions and sequester them underground. We talk about gas being a bridge fuel. The essential piece there, again, is taking the steps to make sure there's another side to that bridge. And that's as much a matter of our political will and our decisions, not just in Washington, but among voters who influence their lawmakers, as it is a matter of economics and technology development.
Well, and if we are ever to reach a point where we walk away from coal entirely, assuming that we don't come up with some sort of magic formula that allows us to, I shouldn't say magic, scientifically effective formula that allows us to really mitigate the greenhouse gas production from coal, we'll also realistically have to remove any economic incentive of producing coal, right? Because people are still going to want what's cheap and readily available.
And that's right. You have to change the incentives. A former Saudi oil minister used to say that the Stone Age didn't end because the world ran out of stones, and the oil age won't end because the world runs out of oil. And I think you could say the same thing about coal. Mm-hmm. The coal age will not end because the world runs out of coal. I think coal will be with us for quite a long time. We have to face up to that. It's one of the reasons that we need to be investing in technologies that help us potentially burn coal with less carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere. But this is not going to happen all of its own regard, particularly when we have a lot of coal plants installed throughout the country where the capital costs are already sunk. You paid for most of it. All you're paying is the incremental cost of putting coal in the plants. And that's just a relatively cheap way to be producing electricity. And so you need a different set of incentives.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Brett on the line now in Louisville. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Chris. I'm really curious about this, and as I understand it, our grid is incredibly inefficient. We produce basically twice as much energy as we actually use that's on the grid to make sure the grid is stable. And I'm wondering if anybody's ever thought of using that excess power that's generated on the grid to do something like produce hydrogen, because you can shut down the production of hydrogen rather quickly instead of firing up a whole new power plant, maybe use that excess energy versus not use it.
That's a great question, and people have been looking for a long time at using excess electricity to produce something, whether it's a stored in a battery so you can use it later, or to pump water uphill so you can run it through a turbine later and produce electricity, or use it to produce hydrogen that you could then use to generate electricity or distribute and have people use in their cars and trucks. The problem so far is that the costs have been prohibitive, and particularly if we're going to use hydrogen to power cars and trucks, you have a chicken and egg problem. People aren't going to buy hydrogen-powered cars and trucks unless there's a robust system for filling them, and people aren't going to build that robust system for filling them unless there are a lot of people with hydrogen-based cars and trucks to use that system. And we see this over and over. It's true also for natural gas vehicles. You don't know which comes first, the distribution system or the vehicles that use it. So I think hydrogen still remains something people look at seriously. Engineers are particularly enthusiastic about hydrogen because it's a very efficient technology. It's just a very sweet technology from an engineering perspective. But right now, we're not seeing big, large-scale deployments of hydrogen. One thing I would say is that as we develop new rules and incentives that encourage clean energy development, we should be making sure there are good incentives to deploy this kind of storage technology that allows you to collect energy when it's relatively cheap to produce it and use it when it's particularly valuable.
Michael Levy is with us. He is Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the new book, The Power Surge, Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael Levy. He is Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the new book, The Power Surge, Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You recommend that we continue to build what you call a resilient energy portfolio. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Sure. The world is very difficult to predict. One of the lessons we should be taking from what's happened in the last few years is that we're pretty bad at anticipating the future. The lesson people seem to have taken is that we should replace our confident views of 5 years ago, that we would be importing massive amounts of natural gas, that our oil production would be rising forever, and replace them with equally confident but fundamentally different views of the future now, that we are awash in natural gas for the next 100 years, that our oil consumption will fall without fail. I think that's dangerous. Energy systems take a long time to develop. They can be in place for decades, if not more. Some of our buildings, which are huge users of energy, are in place for over a century. And those choices need to be resilient to surprising changes in the world and surprising changes in energy. So first, we shouldn't rely on one particular source or one particular technology to solve our big problems. If we need to cut our oil consumption, and we do, we shouldn't just focus on electric cars or just on better conventional vehicles or just on cars and trucks that use natural gas. We should be developing multiple options. When it comes to cutting our carbon emissions, we should be focused not just on renewables and not just on nuclear and not just on tools that allow us to capture and sequester carbon dioxide, but on making sure that we take as good of a shot as we can at having options on multiple fronts. And on oil and gas development, we need to make sure that we have the right rules in place and the right transparency in place so that companies can take advantage of opportunities to develop resources, but so that we're resilient to potential accidents in different parts of the country so that you don't have one bad apple doing things wrong, screw things up for everyone, not just for the industry, but for people who benefit from development and for the country as a whole that is seizing economic and geopolitical gains.
Are there other countries that are doing a better job at building resiliency than we are at this point?
I think we actually are in a very good place when it comes to the diversity of our energy system. I think there are other countries that do a better job of pursuing individual components. Mm-hmm. I think Europeans, for example, put in place a price on oil consumption that reflects the broader damage and broader risks that it causes. I think that there are some efforts in China, for example, to push forward on alternative energy technologies that are more robust than some of what we do here. But we do a lot in part because we're a very large country. We have great wind resources. We have great solar resources. We have great oil and gas resources. And so we're naturally suited to being able to pursue this sort of resilience strategy. What I would say is that instead of just looking for other countries that do a good job, we can look for different institutions in American society that do a good job. One of the things we find is that in our defense planning, it's very natural for us to look at multiple contingencies. We think about different ways the world might evolve in the future. We think about whether various weapon systems that we procure might or might not work, and we build resilience into that system. And defense is a lot like energy in that the decisions you make now will have effects that play out over 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And we can take some lessons from that world in terms of making sure that we build options and that we're resilient to different courses that the future can take.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Ken in the Mid-Cities. Hello, Ken.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Simple question. If I were to decide today that I was going to outfit my house with either a wind system or a solar system that is fed back into the grid for any excess that I might create, how does that work if, say, the grid goes down in a storm? Do I still have power if the wind's blowing or the sun is shining, or am I down with the grid too? I'll take the response off the air.
Thanks for your call.
So you would certainly be more resilient if you have that sort of local generation during a storm. In the worst case, if the power or grid access is cut off, you still have your own generation unless that's been knocked out too. Someone who doesn't have their own generation would be completely without power. So you benefit if there was a big disruption on the broader grid.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Remember, you can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here that asks, has a definitive decision been reached on fracking? Before the market crash of 2008, enormous bonuses were awarded to mineral rights landowners. I'm now torn. If given the chance to accept that kind of check, would I? On the one hand, great good could be done with the money. On the other hand, I wouldn't want fracking to damage our aquifers.
So you need to make an individual decision mm-hmm. on how you see development on your land. And the first thing you want to do is look at the rules in your area. Are those rules ones that you feel comfortable with? And that will vary from place to place. Some of that is at the state level, some of it's national, some of it's local. The other thing you'd want to ask is, do I have the right protections in place in the lease itself? You can build the right protections into a lease. And then it's your own assessment of the costs and benefits there. I don't think there's a universal answer, but I do think it's important for people to be informed as they make decisions. I don't like it when people demonize folks who decide I'm not going to lease my land. everyone makes their own call. I think the country benefits when we're able to develop more of this resource, but everyone has to make their own individual decisions.
I'm really curious, Michael, about, you know, you have taken such a balanced look at all of these technologies and the realities they present environmentally and economically, and in terms of our national security. It must be that you walk into certain conferences, talk with certain groups of people, and they think, oh, I guess he's one of us. But then they realize that you also can see points on the other side. I mean, is that a unique experience? Are there many others like you doing what you do for a living?
It's kind of funny. I was at a meeting last week on clean energy, and there were about 50 people there. And then in the same place right afterwards, there was a meeting on oil and gas, and about 70 people. There were three of us in common across the two meetings. And what's striking is all three of us were relatively young. Mm-hmm. Because we come into a world, first, where things are changing so rapidly that we have to look at those changes and really get a sense of what's happening. We don't come to it with preconceptions from the 1970s. But also because we live in a world where it's obvious that there are geopolitical consequences from energy. It's obvious that energy is entangled in the economy, and it's obvious that we need to do something about climate change. So it's natural for us to be asking these questions across the board and figuring out how the pieces work together. I wish there were more people doing that. There are more than those three people, but it's not an enormous number that are looking across these different areas. I think if we want to figure out what to do, that's absolutely essential. And to me, to understand all of those pieces, I need to understand how the energy system works as a whole.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Garfield in Fort Worth. Hi, Garfield.
Hello, how are you?
Great,
thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I remember when regular gas was 25 cents a gallon, and stations used to even have gas wars to make the price go even down further. Now gas is over $3 a gallon, and we know the oil companies are making billion-dollar profits every quarter. Why is the price of gas so high?
Michael, any thoughts on that?
It's a great question. If you go back to 2000, people would tell you, and serious analysts would generally tell you, that oil would be about $20 a barrel forever. And today, oil is around $100 a barrel, and as the caller said, gasoline is $3, $4, depending on where you are in the country. So what's happened? What's happened is that we're part of a global market, and we've had big new sources of demand for oil, particularly in China and in oil-producing countries, most notably in the Middle East. They themselves are consuming a lot more of their oil and therefore exporting less. At the same time, a lot of those big producers, particularly in the Middle East, that we expected to ramp up supplies in order to keep prices low, didn't. And that collision of increasing demand and stagnant supplies is what's driven prices up to very high levels historically that have caused consumers a lot of pain. I don't see that dynamic fundamentally reversing. If we look at the oil that's being increasingly produced in the United States and in Canada, it's relatively expensive oil to produce. Oil companies are making a lot of money on some of their lower-cost oil, but the margins on some of the newer and more cutting-edge development are considerably smaller. And so if oil prices fell off a lot, we wouldn't see all of that additional production. So I find it hard to foresee a future, at least in the near term, where we are going to have far lower oil prices on a sustained basis. I think in the longer run, if we're able to curb consumption, not just as Americans, but around the world, we have less demand for oil, and therefore we would need less of the ultra-expensive supplies. That would help moderate prices, bring them down over time. But we need to take those active steps to curb not just our consumption, but consumption around the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I just was stopping by to take advantage of a lunch offer, and I was curious that there are a lot of new alternative energy sources, but I'm curious if there's alternative energy sources, where's my jetpack, and what effect are my jetpack emissions going to have on the environment?
Still no jetpacks, Michael.
Yeah, I'm waiting for mine. I'm waiting for mine still. It wouldn't just be efficient. It would be a lot of fun.
When you speak with futurists, is there a sense that we will have very different modes of transportation in the future? I'm not talking about the technology that sort of powers the engine, but is it possible that we will have really strikingly different ways of getting around?
I think that a lot of the different ways of getting around will be ways that we're used to now, but we'll use at larger scale in some parts of the country. Scaling up of transit will be very important. In some places, rail will be particularly important. It really depends on the context. You see some cutting-edge things out there in terms of how we might get around. You see testing of roads where there's a charge that basically runs through the road and essentially refuels your electric car as you're driving around. These are pretty out-there things. You see some proposals for essentially space-based transportation that gets you from one place to another very quickly by shooting you up into space along the way. I don't think we're about to be using that in 5 or 10 years, but people certainly can think outside the box and should think outside the box.
How can we leverage the things we learn by working on our energy situation here in order to foster international trade?
That's a great question, because so many of our energy challenges and our opportunities are international, whether that is in exporting the technologies we've developed for fossil fuels or alternative energy, or in cutting global oil consumption or carbon emissions to reduce our geopolitical and climate risks. The first thing that we need to do is make sure we have as open markets as possible for trade and investment, so that a U.S. company can go and invest in China and develop oil or gas or wind turbines or solar, but also open trade environments so that for the technologies where it works, we can produce them here and export them elsewhere. So having that right trade environment is essential. The other piece is we need to work with other countries to boost demand for a lot of these products. So if we're developing cutting-edge technology that allows you to cut your oil consumption, then it's to our benefit if other countries adopt policies that increase demand for those technologies. I'll give you an example on the solar part of things. I visited a factory outside of Pittsburgh that was making big mirrors for utility-scale solar production. And it had fallen on fairly rough times because incentives in the United States were limited. But when I asked one of the managers, where are you shipping these huge, heavy solar mirrors to, they said, we're shipping them to India because India has an aggressive set of policies to promote the adoption of solar power. And it has friendly enough trade rules, not completely perfect, but friendly enough trade rules that this company could profitably sell into the Indian market. So we have to have that framework in place, the open opportunities for trade, but also the demand elsewhere in the world.
And as we move forward, we simply have to make sure that our new choices don't take us backwards on things like security and the environment.
I think that's absolutely right. We're seeing big gains from the market, big gains from technology, and those are fantastic. We should figure out how to lean into them more. But we shouldn't get lazy at the same time. We shouldn't go through this sort of shock and trance process of panicking and then saying everything is okay and then going back into panic again.
Michael Levy is Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called The Power Surge: Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. Michael, it's been a really interesting discussion. I so appreciate you spending this hour with us.
It was my pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect, and our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free every day at kera.org/think. And of course, we always want to hear from you. We welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.